It is Saturday morning. It is 10 o'clock. This is the Banwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Banwee.
And I'm Adam Banwee.
And I'm Craig Beechler.
Nick DeBlasey.
Well, as you might have noticed, that took a little longer than usual, and there's good reason for that. First is the extensive time delay between Cincinnati and here. Well, no, that part isn't really that bad. But, Adam is in Cincinnati. I am here holding down the fort with Lauren. And those of you who have been loyal listeners for a long time will remember Craig Beechler. He has been in the studio with us, sitting right across from me. He's also been on the phone before. And he has a variety of roles that he plays in the financial arena up there, unlike the kind of finance we deal with. He's been an entrepreneur, investor type, angel investor, and VC guy, on and on and on. And today, Adam went up for the football game and didn't do quite well enough, but he tried very hard.
It was so close.
Yeah, it was. I don't want to talk about it. It's so close. Anyway, they're happy because they're from Cincinnati. What the heck? So two out of three up there. We have had a lot of comments when Craig's been on the show because people do wonder about how do you get something going if you've got an idea. And I refer frequently to the four factors of production: land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurism. Easy for me to say. And when you don't have one out of those four, you don't have anything. And a lot of people have good ideas and places to do them, but they don't have the capital, and that's when people like Craig step in. So we're going to be talking about that today. We'll find out what it is that Nick does exactly, but that's just an application of the concept that we like to talk about, which is if you are one of those people and if you think you've got something that could go, how do you go about just putting your foot in the water? It cannot be easy, and I imagine it's starting to get more and more complicated with the new administration, so we've got a lot of questions. Meanwhile, we'll issue a short, in fact, I could do it myself real easy, a short market wrap. Yuck. How's that?
Yeah. Do we have to? Can we just skip that part?
You said it would be fast. Make it fast.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah, I'm pretty happy September is over.
No kidding.
October started with a bang on Friday, had a really good day, but we needed it because the last 4 days before that were just no good. September is actually the worst month of the year for stocks, and it pretty much just held true to form this year. Ended with another rough day on Thursday. All three indexes had big drops after, and it was a pattern of futures being up and then daytime sell-off, and that was pretty persistent throughout the week. We ended, Friday brought an end to the quarter, and it actually wasn't that bad. The quarter actually ended positive for the S&P just barely. and then the Dow and the NASDAQ were both down, so just happy to get through September, cut our losses, and move on to what is actually the three best months of the year, being the fourth quarter. So you may not know that, but all 3 months have average gains for the last 100 years. If you look at November, December, those are actually two of the best months of the year. So looking forward to getting into those months and putting September behind us. For the quarter, there were two assets that did very, very well, and they actually both had double-digit drops in September, but still managed huge gains. Natural gas and Ethereum, which is a crypto, they saw gains of 54 and 27% respectively. And that was interesting because during the quarter, there was a lot of news about crypto. If you remember, China banned all cryptocurrency transactions a few weeks ago. And then also El Salvador made Bitcoin a national currency during the quarter. So lots of news coming out about crypto. And Bitcoin actually had a nice quarter, too. It was up double digits as well, despite a big loss in September. So interesting stuff going on. The natural gas thing, I mean, talk about a volatile asset class.
It's been up
50% this quarter. It was down, I believe, 80% at one point last year, so it's just been all over the place. Within the S&P 500, there were a couple of winners and a couple of losers. Financials was the big winner, up 2.8%. despite an almost 2% fall in September. Utilities were also up about 1.8% in the quarter. Energy was kind of the opposite story, gained almost 9% in September, kind of bucking the trend of everything else going down. And despite the exit from stocks, bonds were not the big winner during the quarter. They were relatively flat, and a lot of that came because interest rates started to rise at the end of the quarter. So, in summary, happy to move on to October. Off to a good start so far. Hopefully that continues next week.
Yeah, and things could be a lot better with just a few little changes, but we got to get people to go to work. And I don't know what it's going to take anymore. I thought there'd be more positive momentum on that after they canceled the extra payments. But
it's happening. It's taken a while.
It's taken some time.
It's happening.
Yep. And then, of course, the supply chain is an absolute nightmare right now. There's a lot of problems out there. And that's not
about it.
Yeah. And that's not to mention even the political brouhaha that is generally D.C., but is not generally quite this bad.
I think it's been this bad for years.
Well, you probably. You know, I credit yesterday's big booming day to the fact that they didn't get anything done. That's my kind of day when they get nothing done. No harm, no foul.
I'm really excited about today's show because we're here on site at a company called Juno DTS. And Nick, who's sitting with me, is one of the co-founders. And it's a manufacturing business. I'm going to let him talk about it because he knows way more about it than
sure.
I do. But it's in the startup phase, I guess, but they are in production. And so they're running, but they're still going through the process of raising money and expanding. And it's a really interesting story. So I want to introduce Nick DeBlasi and let him talk about his business a little bit.
Okay. Hello, let's set the table, as I say, before the break.
Really appreciate the invitation for being here. Thank you very much and coming to see our facility. I know it's not much, but it sounds like you guys have a little history in manufacturing, which is kind of fun.
We do. For those of you that don't know, my dad has owned a manufacturing business in the Midwest in the large portion of the 80s and 90s, I believe. So definitely a background in manufacturing.
And we joke around that the Midwest is literally the Silicon Valley of making things. We are the masters of manufacturing.
That's right. Parts is parts.
So we find that's exactly right. Exactly right. So Juno DTS is a digital printing company. DTS stands for direct to shape. So we decorate anything that's not flat is really the key to the entire thing. So
that's the 1 minute.
So you can.
So in this case, our go-to-market strategy actually is the craft beer industry. What's really fun about pairing a super cutting-edge technology with a 2,000-year-old history is like the opposite end of the spectrum. So it's opened a world to me that's just really, really fun to work in. And we've collected an engineering group that can master the challenge of placing a dot within 10,000ths of an inch. More than a billion times in 1 second, which is just very exciting.
Whoa. That's quick. All right, when we come back from the break, let's start from where the idea came from and how you went about starting it up from location and everything to money and the whole deal. And we'll get into how people could emulate that if they need to. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Vanwee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanwee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee. I'm Craig Beechler.
Nick DeBlasi.
And the four of us are going to take a little cruise through what it takes to get a business up and running. But I want to remind everybody, lines are open, 904-222-8255 or 222-TALK. And if we don't get you on quite as immediately as usual, I promise you, you will not wait long. Just due to the format today, we might be in the middle of something, we can't interrupt for a minute or two, but we'll be here. The trivia question today, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. And it's kind of an interesting thing. I challenge everybody. I'm going to tell you, you won't get it right. It's a toughie. But in what country today do you find the largest percentage of investors who are female? And that only narrowed it down to, what, a couple hundred countries? Realistically, fewer than that, but lots and lots and lots. The largest percentage of investors who are female. All right, let's dig in. Well, you wake up one morning and this idea comes to your head and say, wow, I'd like to print up some beer cans. Is that how it goes?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you that's true. It's just not. I woke up actually one morning and I found myself in love with a girl, got married to her, and she moved me to Cincinnati just because that's what you do in Cincinnati. So I actually came to this city before I even had a job.
I did the same thing in Racine. My wife was from there, and she moved me there, and I didn't have a job, but it was a good move.
What a blessing, though. I mean, this woman's blessed me with five wonderful daughters, and I love this city like you wouldn't believe. I mean, I was Ohio-born and raised to begin with, so I already liked it. Then coming here was just absolutely spectacular. We have great connections, and it's just good, incredibly hardworking people that we surround ourselves with. So, in all honesty, I'm a mechanical engineer. That's my background. If you end up in Cincinnati, at one point you probably cross paths with a company by the name of Procter & Gamble.
I've heard of them.
You may have, right? In consumer packaged goods, they're literally the best in the world. They just are. So as an engineer, I did some contracting for them in and out for several years. And I had the opportunity to learn from them and understand how things actually get done. So what a blessing that was.
Yeah, that's a Midwestern concept. How do you make things?
Yeah. Exactly right. I mean, literally, I lived on the show How Stuff Works every day.
Cool.
I remember standing next to lines, and you know, it costs X number of dollars for these lines to be down on a per-minute basis, and you need to get them fixed. You need to get them to run, or there's something new that's coming out that you need to have old assets figured out how to go. So as an engineer, it just was really fun for me to learn how to solve problems. You put a problem in front of me, and I was like a pig in the mud trying to figure out how to solve it.
Is that how the idea for this business came about? Were you trying to solve a problem?
The key is that the problem kind of came to us. We had some friends that were part of the brewing industry, and they had a challenge in the fact that they could not get a product that didn't have a label or a shrink sleeve on it in less than a full semi's worth of parts, which is 200,000. Even some of the larger breweries here in Cincinnati, a couple of ours are Rheingeist and Mantry. I actually walked through and they would say, hey, you know, on our seasonals are really custom, super craft runs. This can take us 4 years worth of inventory to run that many cans.
Yuck.
And I walked through their warehouses and their facilities, and I actually love beer, like my friend Craig Beachler here. and I would walk through these warehouses, and I'd see beer cans from these companies and be like, hey, I've never had that. Why do you have all these cans? And they said, well, we made it once, and it just wasn't very good. Do you want the cans? We are going to throw them all away. 170,000 of them right there. Now, the good news is they don't throw them away because aluminum is forever recyclable.
Right.
So they actually kind of came to us a little bit and said, hey, can you solve this problem? And as it turned out, we had some very, very good friends. There's a guy named Daniel Pink who wrote a book years ago called Free Agent Nation. And it kind of talked about free agents becoming almost a gig economy like writers do. And as an engineer, I got to tell you, I actually was that. I lived that world because they didn't want to pay an engineer to sit around the water cooler. So you came in for a project, you solved it, and you left. And that was the way that it kind of worked. And that's actually how I met these guys who are now my co-founders. In a number of 20 years of working in the industry, I got to work with hundreds of engineers. And when it came time for me to play a little game we now like to call Bet Your House, I handpicked these ones that are really just spectacular individuals that are so very, very good at what they do. And each of us have our own particular lane in that works. I can't actually imagine what it would be like to be a single co-founder, just because it's almost overwhelming how much you have to do and juggle. And I've been blessed to be surrounded by people that are, thank God, smarter than I am.
So you have the idea, sort of brought to you by the beer industry. You have the co-founder, you've got everything set up, then what? How do you get this place? How do you get the equipment? What happened next?
A little bit by accident. Thank God my oldest brother is very good at giving back and loves baseball. So he helped create a baseball field in Columbus called Buddy Ball, and I'm going to shamelessly plug it right now because it allows anyone to play baseball. My little brother has been in special education his entire life, and Buddy Ball pairs a special ed kid with a normal person, or a helper, I should say, and puts them on the field, and they get to play baseball, and they design these fields. It's absolutely spectacular. So I went to Grove City to see the first field that was made for this, and I'm sitting next to my cousin, and I'm like, just catching up. And I tell him, you know, the breweries have this problem, and I think I can solve it, and I know a couple of guys. And he said, okay, I'll invest in that. And I wasn't even asking him. And you know, a week later, he actually gave us an angel investment to build a test stand. Mm-hmm. And within 3 months, we actually had it working. We were dropping dots on a beer can, making some pretty neat images, actually. So it was a lot of luck, I would say, actually, in the very beginning. A friend of ours let us use his basement in his technical distribution facility. So they had $3 million worth of photo eyes and stuff right next to us, and he gives us his key to actually utilize this little space.
And when was this, like circa, like mm-hmm. 2017?
Yeah, it was probably 18, 19, right? That's exactly right. So we build this little thing, and then it starts to move forward from there.
So you were able to prove your concepts, and it worked.
Kind of, yes. It works good enough, right? Okay. So we raised $150,000 in an angel investment on a convertible debt round with a $2 million ceiling. And it was a good risk for my cousin, and we built one little thing with one little print head. And it's actually funny. To this day, I have this little case that has literally a piece of wood on the back of it in power supplies and electronics actually hand-screwed to it. And my buddies actually still laugh at me that I built this thing. But it did. It proved that the idea was workable, that we could print on something that was weird like this, that we could actually make it work. And then that proof of concept, actually, we then built out into something that could do the entire CMYK five-color, full-color gamut, and actually go after a seed round to fund the company to actually launch.
Okay. And what was your target for that seed round? Do you have an idea of how much you needed based on what you were trying to do, or were you just kind of open to what will you give me?
Well, as engineers, we like to define things, right?
Sure.
So we had actually a shockingly difficult Excel model that my brother helped me put together again as a CPA. We had everything crossed and dotted. We knew we needed $2 million as an absolute bare minimum. We were going to go after $3 million. Several people said in Cincinnati, you're just not going to get that, Nick. That's not what startups get. You're going to have to figure something else out. And honestly, I was worried about it because I hadn't learned about any of this. I didn't know how to do it. Someone introduced us to now a dear friend of mine, Craig Beachler. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Nick and I met through a couple bankers downtown that I know who have clients, private wealth type clients that enjoy doing angel or willing to take that kind of risk. And as I've said on the program before, if you look up the data from the Kauffman Foundation, who's basically the kind of the nonprofit governing body of the startup world, you know, 7 out of 10 of these deals go to zero within 3 years. Meaning, you say you invest $50,000 or $100,000 on a $2 million round, 3 years later that company doesn't exist. And 2 out of 10 generally double your money, and 1 out of 10 is the 10x home run that fuels hopefully future investment. So hopefully you find that 1 out of 10 sooner. Nick and I being introduced to these folks, and my passion here in Cincinnati outside of my day job around raising capital, I have a little consulting business called Fountain Square Capital with a partner out of St. Louis who came out of the banking industry. She's awesome, couldn't make the show today. But we just continued the relationship, and I do have a background of investing in craft beer companies, so I tend to know that market pretty well. And the people and the players, and whenever you get into any particular market, you know, the more you know, the more people you know, the better you understand the investment. So as Nick and Crystal and I worked, I think that was in November of 2019, we had hours and hours of conversation. As he looked at raising $3 million, we encouraged him to raise $4 million. And I think as this break is coming up, as we wind down for the next segment, we'll kind of tell you how that went and what happened in January 2020.
Great.
Yeah, there's a couple things that most people don't understand. One of them is that most businesses, when they go under, are profitable at the time. They run out of money. So I loved your concept already, and we'll get right back to it. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee. I'm Craig Beechler.
Nick DeBlasey.
And we are sort of in the middle of a discussion involving starting up a business. I do want to remind everybody that the lines are open, 904-222-8255, so don't hesitate to call. It's still a call-in question show. Also, the trivia question is still on the table. In what country today would you find that the largest number of percentage of investors, are women? All right, so we've got a little concept. By the way, I used to do some of that Excel stuff, too, the same thing you're talking about. And we'd get to a certain point, and I'd tell the people, okay, you tell me why you're not going out of business on this exact day, because you will not have the money to perpetuate it. Yes, you'll be making money, but not enough to perpetuate it. And it stuck a lot of people. So I'd love the concept of overcapitalizing or at least having some resources. You got to know Craig's phone number, I guess.
Yeah, We certainly know at Fountain Square Capital, we as consultants, we're not, just to be clear to folks listening, we're not a dealer broker, right? So there's neither Crystal nor I went through all the required education and testing. So what we do is bring capital together, right? We can, and that's how Nick and I work together, is we brought people in the community. Nick also hustled his you-know-what off in the Midwest. And one of the things I think the listeners would find interesting is that, you know, the Midwest, basically ranging from Nebraska to the eastern edge of Ohio up to Michigan, it's the fourth largest economy in the world, right? California always brags about being the sixth largest if they ever seceded. But that's one of the things I think we're really proud of, is that Midwestern ethos and the blocking and tackling of manufacturing. And those aren't always the most glamorous businesses to invest in, but I invested in a software startup a couple years ago. It's going to be the next big app, the next big Snapchat. You know, this local prodigy went to Stanford, quit Stanford kind of thing. And that became one of the casualties that I mentioned of the 7 of 10, that all that capital that we put in went to zero. So I have nothing to show for that. And that's the risk you take. And then I realized through that loss and that learning that investing in guys like Nick is really important, the blocking and tackling, the non-glamorous, non-sexy Midwest manufacturing. The interstates of America are filled with these businesses off the side of the road that produce 10, 15, 25, 30 million in sales, and you've never heard of them, but they're doing really well. So in November of 2019, my partner at Fountain Square Capital, Crystal, and I are having these conversations with Nick in a consulting capacity. And, you know, as I sit here across from Nick, as a co-founder of Juno DTS, we're always considering and balancing out what's the valuation of the business, which is somewhat nebulous to peg, especially when you're dealing with simply a 20-page deck and four to five experts or SME, subject matter experts, and the investor. So you finally agree upon a valuation, and then you say, okay, how much of this business, like, do I want to sell? It's no different than going into Target saying, hey, there's a $20 shirt I want to buy. Can I afford it all? Yes. If you can, maybe you put a down payment on it and you put down $5, then you own 25% of the shirt. And so the valuation on this business came in around 11 to 12 million as the deck, as a pitch. And Nick, you guys thought you wanted to raise three. So kind of walk us through those conversations.
Well, and it's interesting, right? Because as an engineer, creating a valuation is almost impossible, because the justification of it is very difficult. It's all assumption-based. Everything is assumption-based. And if you play a model, you can make assumptions left or right. We actually have an investor that has taught me quite a bit, because he took my model and within 10 seconds cut everything in half and said, hey, look at this. You can still survive when you miss it by that much. I like that, right? So you have, you know, your low estimates, your high estimates, what you hope things to be. And I just got stuck. I got mired in the entire thing. I got to tell you, I got so mired in it that I'm like, I don't know if I can actually figure out how to make this valuation real. And what got me unstuck is my sweet wife, who is just a grounded, awesome individual. And she actually looked at me and said, Nick, you have to stop doing this. Like, completely, we're out of money. Our family doesn't have any money. You have to stop. And I literally, it just absolutely catapulted me forward to the fact where I knew that we loved this. We were good at it. We're top 5% in the world of being able to do it. And that just pushed me into, all right, let's go see. And we went to see, and then subsequently, Craig gave us the best advice on the planet, because all the folks who told us that we were probably not even able to raise $3 million in Cincinnati, we got a wonderful response, because people here do understand manufacturing, and they do understand hard work. And we had the ability, we oversubscribed very, very quickly. And, wow. And I mean within 2 weeks, we had done four scheduled pitches, and we had oversubscribed to $4.2 million.
That's correct. I mean, that is not the typical story.
No.
I hear that all the time. They're like, that's insane. How did this happen? And again, I think the interesting thing of how it actually happened isn't because our engineering core is so good, and it's certainly not because I'm smarter than anybody in this area. It's advice, again, I got from another advisor. I'm sitting across from a gentleman by the name of Andy Walter, who is our digital advisor, and this guy continues to blow my mind every time I talk to him about what we are and where the world is going. But Andy, actually, my brother-in-law got me a meeting via LinkedIn with this Andy Walter guy that I specifically asked him to go find, because he's a Cincinnati connector. I mean, if there's 7 degrees of second separation, Nick Riley is 1 degree of Cincinnati and probably all the way to Chicago. But in either case, he gets me a quick meeting with Andy Walter. Andy and I have coffee for 10 minutes. And within 10 minutes, Andy's like, oh, thank God, I thought you were going to start a data analytics company, and I was going to tell you you're 10 years too late. I showed him a video of this little test stand we built, and lo and behold, he's like, that's pretty neat. We need to have another meeting. I don't have enough time. I met him about a week later, and he gave me the second best piece of advice. So Craig Beechler helped me accept more money than I thought I need, which we'll go into why I needed it in a minute here, I'm sure. But Andy Walter then told me, or asked me, actually, he said, who's on your advisory board? And I said, my what?
And he
said, Nick, you guys are smart, right? I know you're smart. I know you have a good background. If I look at the guys in your stable, your team is amazing. But the advisory board is what makes the world actually believe that you can do it. These are people with experience in your field or in what you're trying to do. And within 2 seconds, he said, that's also how you find out if you're full of BS or not, actually, is if these people actually will take their time to be on your board, you know, you probably have something. And within the same sentence, I said, hey, Andy, do you want to be on my advisory board? and thank God he said yes. So we collected a gentleman by the name of Omar Robinson, who runs the second largest brewery in Indiana. And a lot of other people. We had about five. They're just absolutely spectacular individuals. And I have to tell you, the learning I receive from these people is basically beyond a master's in business, because it's inside of the industry you're actually trying to do. But then as we go into the raise, just having their names or having them stand up at a raise and say, hey, you know, I run a large brewery and I believe that these guys are going to solve my problem. Or, you know, I've been in the CPG world at Procter & Gamble, and I think they have something here maybe. And that really does mean a lot. So Craig, you want to talk a little bit about that advice you gave me?
Yeah, so Chris and I, in talking with Nick in November 2019, we're like, we understand as a founder, co-founder, you're trying to balance out between how much you sell or how much you raise, which is the same thing, right? Because you want to keep as much equity as possible, but you also know you need cash for your burn rate, right? That's what we talk about in the startup world. What's your monthly burn? What's your burn rate? How much capital are you running through? So with this potential situation of oversubscription, we thought, dude, you need to take the extra million you can get, because you may not always get this. And when you're doing a pitch, you're doing it around, it's emotional. Like, Nick is not BSing when he says his wife and him were basically mortgaging their future to start this business against their equity in their home. And then you're coming out to pitch investors. That's called having some stake in the game, right? Like, you know that they're into this. So that extra million, we all happen to know in March 2020, a little global pandemic came along, and that million became very important to keep this business alive.
Now, the oldest line there is the guy that says, I'd rather have 100% of nothing than your deal. And you know how that works out. That's how well. All right, we're going to take one more break, and we'll wrap up the discussion. I know Nick doesn't have to have much time left, but we've got Craig back, and we can get a little insight after that, too. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee. Craig Beechler.
Nick DeBlasey.
And we're just sort of wrapping up a little bit with Cincinnati's favorite soccer dad who has to run for an appointment. But we're talking about a startup business and getting it funded, getting it open. Can I assume that you're looking at this as a job shop?
Actually, it's kind of a hybrid blend between manufacturing, service, and technology, to be honest with you.
Okay, interesting. The problem with shorter runs, obviously, is setup time. So if you've got quick changeovers and you can go from one manufacturer to another, that would help, and I assume in the digital world that kind of happens.
You hit the nail on the head right there. That's actually what we do better than anyone in the world. We can do on-the-fly changeovers. Literally.
Oh, that's cool. Neat.
Yeah, Steve, if you saw this operation, I think you'd be blown away on the engineering side, just that essentially they can print one can per second, 60 cans per minute, and customize high-res, high-speed. So you can print, let's say, a can of Truth, which is an IPA from Rheingeist. You go to Madtree, or you can print cans for someone's wedding at the Ritz-Carlton in Sarasota for this coming weekend, right?
Exactly, right.
Low volume, nice. High volume, completely customizable with no downtime. And I'm sitting here looking at some of their product, and it's really, really nice. I mean, it's beautiful.
Well, where's it going? That's before you go, where is it going?
We happen to be in Cincinnati, so as far as, like, the literal where it's going, we can ship to half the country within a day, really two-thirds the entire industry. But where it's going is the technology we tell people is direct to shape, which means we can print on anything that's not flat. We do three-dimensional objects, so we tell people we can print on a beer can and an airplane. Now, as a startup, you better be focused. Or, like you said, Steve, you're going to run out of cash. Cash is king in the entire thing. So we had to focus. Luckily, when I met Craig, he already knew what the beer industry was. And we had a vertical that could actually utilize what we make. It's one thing to have a better mousetrap, which we, in fact, do. But it doesn't actually matter unless the world really needs it.
Yeah. And looking at the business and understanding the craft brewing industry, the problem that Nick kind of described in an earlier segment essentially is, if you're a smaller craft brewery, which 90% of the United States craft breweries, some say there's 7,000-8,000 left after the pandemic, 90% of them brew less than 10,000 barrels a year. One barrel being two of the half barrels you may remember from your college days, right? That's 31 gallons, I believe. 15 and a half gallons is a half barrel. So if you're brewing less than that, you're not running canning lines where you can in 10, 20,000 beers at a time. You're happy to run 1,000 cans, if you even sell cans, not just out of the tap at your little local craft microbrew, right? So they solve this problem where the shrink sleeve that typically comes on a lot of these cans, which is plastic, sloughs off in any body of water. It also gums up recycling machines. Nick mentioned this earlier, didn't go into a lot of detail, but aluminum as a physical property of that particular periodic table element is infinitely recyclable. You can heat melt. Plastic is not, right? Plastic, one time you drink a plastic bottle, that never turns into a plastic bottle again. It can go into a coat, maybe Patagonia uses it, something like that. But that's one of the best properties of aluminum. And then anyone that's ever bought craft beer at the store has seen this like paper wrap around just raw aluminum. That just doesn't look that great. If you're running your craft beer business, doing $3-4 million a year, small business, you want your cans to look as good as anybody else.
It's a competitive market, and you need to stand out.
Juno solves that problem. So right, we go ahead, Nick agrees, and begrudgingly, even though the data, he didn't really necessarily need it based on his spreadsheet, he took the advice, raised an extra million. That deal closes in January 2020. Everybody,
right.
My group, other groups around the Midwest, from Chicago to Columbus to Cincinnati, invested, and then walk us through what happens from March 2020 to today.
Yeah, so we start the company. We're, you know, on cloud nine that we got this response. Having a good lawyer is probably one of the most important pieces of advice I can give anyone. Not only is the documentation important, but the advice, again, is like they're another advisor, honestly. And the guys down at TAP, Rob McDonald helps me out down there, and his guidance and advice has been it's immeasurable. It's actually priceless in how he's helped us kind of manage and understand and learn our way actually through how to do any of this. So, you know, we get started, we start designing how to build our full-blown manufacturing piece of equipment, begin putting stuff on the floor, and the pandemic hits. And we thought, you know, this isn't that big of a deal. This can't possibly last more than a few months, right? And holy moly, doesn't
yeah.
it, right? It lasts. You know, as we all know, it just lasts so long that our deliverables actually didn't even happen. Stuff that I was supposed to receive in October, I didn't get until February of the following year, and it really, really hurt us. So we began to actually run out of runway. We began to run out of actual money. Had I not accepted that advice that Craig gave me, we would have run out of cash. And like Steve said, cash for a startup is everything. If you don't have it, it doesn't matter.
And try raising capital in the middle of a pandemic, right? Good luck. Right, people are really tight. Their hands are fist in the pocket at that time. So then, have you gone on to raise more capital since then?
We actually have. So actually, in December, I'm sweating bullets, and I'm kind of back in the spot where we're not out of money. We still have easily $1 million left. But as a good leader, I hope to be. I'm looking forward, and I'm looking at 6 months, and I'm looking at 12 months, and I'm like, we're not going to make the targets that I want to make. There's just no way. So I make a quick call again to my lawyer. I said, hey, Rob, I don't like what my runway looks like. I didn't predict any of this. Like, we can't buy cans. There's a can shortage across the entire country that equates the number of cans the entire craft brewing industry actually buys. This isn't a Juno problem. This is literally, we're short the entire industry of cans. We're looking to source them for different countries, different people. We have equipment that hasn't arrived. There's a chip shortage that still to this day is shutting down the automotive manufacturing group. We buy some of the same chips that they actually need, which is not great for us. We had to source some chips, overnighting them from Japan to even make some of the stuff that we make.
Wow.
So there's challenges that we didn't predict. These are things that, I mean, I could have ordered cans without even thinking about it and getting them within a month or two, and actually they weren't even accepting orders. They were telling us, no, you're not even on the list of customers that we have.
And to put that in perspective, companies as quote small as Coca-Cola, Anheuser-Busch, AB InBev, they went on allocation from all the major aluminum manufacturers like Crown and Vasis and Ball, who produce a lot of the raw cans. They said to these massive multinational billion-dollar companies, hey, sorry, retail sales have spiked so much because all the bars and restaurants have shut down. You're not doing any what they call on-premise sales. So everyone's running to their local Kroger or Piggly Wiggly and buying their 12-pack or their case. And so the aluminum just flew off the shelves, and therefore Juno could have been a casualty of that.
That's 100%. So I put my hand up and say, hey, Rob, how are we going to do this? I have to order $500,000 worth of cans, when before I never had to put that kind of cash out because it exists. And I said, I don't know how to do it. He said, we'll do a safe, S-A-F-E. Beach, you want to tell people what that is?
Yeah, that's a really cool legal product for the startup world. It stands for Simple Agreement for Future Equity. And there's the group in San Francisco, Y Combinator. It's the first ever accelerator in the country. And essentially what an accelerator is, and I know you guys have one in Jacksonville now, they're also called incubators. So it's a basic one-stop shop for an entrepreneur who maybe doesn't fully understand the full business, but they have a great idea and they're passionate and they want to do it. You come with your accountant, your web developer, your potential engineering services, and usually these accelerators like Y Combinator will make an investment, usually about $100,000, and they get 6% of the company. It's kind of a standard deal. Well, the hardest part about raising money is often the valuation. How do you have a pitch deck, and then you tell me based on these 20 slides your business is worth $11 or $12 million? So that's what you're saying that price of the shirt is at Target. You're saying it's $20 and it's not moving. Well, some people may like that deal, some people may not. So as you go on to raise future capital, instead of having an actual expensive event where you have to bring in experts to value the business of where it is today, you say, look, we get it. This is a pretty cool business, but we don't want to do the valuation. We'll push it off down the road until there is an actual event. Either you become bankable, which means, you know, you have enough P&L on your books that a bank says, yes, I'll help finance your next line extension, or you go out to a major funding round with venture capital. And one step back in the VC world, so everybody gets it, the reason these founders have to go out to private equity or angel rounds is because banks don't invest in startups. So that all being said, Juno did this safe, just closed another $2 million, of which myself and others participated in, and that will allow Juno to do what?
Build our capacity and really fill out our inventory.
Cool. All right, well, the music's playing. We got to run. Thanks to everybody up there. We knew you win, so when you're rich and famous, give us a call. And no one would have guessed it right anyway, but the country with the highest percentage of women investors is the Philippines. Never would have come up with that. Okay, thanks again. Have a good trip home, Adam, and I hope your soccer game goes well. Tell them we're the reason you're late. This is the Ben Wee Financial Hour.